Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz in Washington. Today on the program, we report on fears among some Indonesians that the rise of the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq could create new extremist movements among the country's large Muslim population.
The Indonesians, for the first time, saw the Islamic State as a challenge to Indonesian sovereignty.
Then, we report on the actions of officials in the American island state of Hawaii to prepare people for the possibility of an extreme tsunami.
If this event took place, we'd have to move 340,000 to 350,000 people to safety, a much more daunting task.
Concerns about the development of Islamic terrorism in Indonesia and worries about the effect of a super tsunami on Hawaii. Those are our stories today. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the voice of America, and this is our daily program, As It Is. The last major terrorist attack in Indonesia happened in 2009. At the time, terrorists bombed two hotels in Jakarta. Since then, the Indonesian government has reduced terrorist threats by capturing, not killing, terrorist leaders, such as clergyman Abu Bakar Bashir. His trial, and others, helped turn public opinion against violent militants. But as Kelly Jean Kelly tells us, the terrorist threat has now returned to the island nation.
Recently, an online video showed an Indonesian man who claimed to be an Islamic State fighter in Syria. He called on Muslims to rise up against the government in Jakarta. The video showed many Indonesians their own war against terrorism is not over. Sydney Jones is with the Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict in Jakarta. She calls the video a wake-up call.
The Indonesians, for the first time, saw the Islamic State as a challenge to Indonesian sovereignty. That's what triggered the reaction. It wasn't that all of a sudden it became more dangerous.
Indonesian police arrested several local Islamic State supporters after the video was released. Some human rights groups are concerned about how the police have answered the video. They say the measures have been too strong and that citizens have not been able to examine the police action. But the Indonesian government is not changing its counterterrorism policy. The government said it will continue to use police and lawyers to reduce terrorism. Some Islamic leaders also have suggested blocking foreign groups from providing money to religious education in Indonesia. Such a ban would include Muslim and Christian organizations. Sydney Jones of the Institute for Policy Analysis of Conflict says more Indonesian Muslims are using social media to speak against the extreme violence of the Islamic State. She says most Muslims in Indonesia are surprised and concerned about what the Islamic State is doing.
One of the interesting things about the emergence of the Islamic State is how horrified most mainstream Muslims are in Indonesia.
Outside Jakarta, the Indonesian government is paying for programs opposed to extremist Islamic beliefs. At the Al Hikam boarding school, young Indonesian men are learning moderate Muslim teachings. Arif Zamhari is the director of the program.
We spread a virus of peaceful Islam to community here. The problem here, because the loudest voice are from the radical, so our moderate groups never speak out.
Arif Zamhari says the newly trained religious leaders will speak in mosques across the country. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
You are listening to As It Is from The Voice of America. Scientists say rising temperatures on Earth's surface are to blame for rising sea levels. The reality of rising sea levels means many coastal and island communities are at risk when a tsunami strikes. The island state of Hawaii is taking steps to prepare for tsunami waves. Officials there want to be ready if such an event takes place. In 2011, a strong earthquake struck northeastern Japan. The quake caused a tsunami. The huge waves damaged several nuclear reactors in the area. Those events led Hawaiian officials to reconsider their plan of action for dealing with a tsunami. Scientists and emergency officials in the state are now preparing for an extreme tsunami, the kind that comes every 500 to 1,000 years. Almost 19,000 people died when the earthquake and tsunami struck Japan 4 years ago. Scientists say the Hawaiian Islands may be just as helpless if such a disaster were to take place there. Rhett Butler is a researcher at the University of Hawaii. He says a mysterious hole on the island of Kauai has evidence that a huge tsunami hit Hawaii 500 years ago. David Burney discovered the evidence. He found remains of old shells, coral, and other sea creatures in a cave about 100 meters from the ocean. Civil defense agencies keep people prepared by testing their tsunami warning system. Scientists say a major tsunami could happen again. They warn that if a powerful earthquake struck the Aleutian Islands in the northern Pacific, a super tsunami could follow. A researcher at the University of Hawaii created a computer model to show what would happen if an earthquake struck the Aleutians and produced a tsunami. The model showed the waves from a major quake could move further inland across Hawaii than officials thought, deep into areas considered safe. The Hawaii Emergency Management Agency works with local governments to create disaster plans. Kevin Richards is an emergency planner with the agency. He says before the computer model, Hawaiian officials thought they would only have to evacuate 85,000 people from the island of Oahu.
If this event took place, we'd have to move 340,000 to 350,000 people to safety, a much more daunting task. And safety is not in the same place anymore. It's much further away. It's further up the hill. It's further inland.
Some Hawaiians could drive to higher ground. But driving is not possible in some parts of Hawaii, so people would have to walk to safety or go to the fourth floor or higher of a reinforced concrete building. Officials are now developing a new plan of action with an extended evacuation zone for an extreme tsunami. Scientist Rhett Butler says because of what happened in Japan in 2011, people take the threat seriously.
It doesn't mean it's going to happen in our time. It doesn't mean it's going to happen this year, next year. But it's just the nature of the tectonic forces on our planet. They just keep marching along, and once you relieve all these stresses with these truly great earthquakes, the water responds.
That's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you. and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Cruz at the VOA Learning English headquarters in Washington. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Technology Report. The makers and pilots of a solar-powered plane will try to fly it around the world beginning next month. The plane is called Solar Impulse 2, or SI-2. It arrived in pieces recently in Abu Dhabi in the United Arab Emirates. The plane's material is mostly plastic strengthened with lightweight glass. It is now being assembled and prepared for its journey around the globe. The SI-2 team plans to circumnavigate the Earth in 25 flying days over a 5-month period. The idea was first tested by Solar Impulse 1 in 2012. Pilots flew the plane on an intercontinental flight from Switzerland to Morocco. And in the summer of 2013, the plane was flown across the United States, from San Francisco to New York City. The plane's wings are 72 meters across. They are covered with more than 17,000 solar cells. These special energy storage containers provide power to the batteries that permit the plane's 4 electric motors to operate at night. Only one person can sit in the SI-2. In March, the first pilot will take off from Abu Dhabi and fly along the equator, where the sun's rays are strongest. The plane will land every few days so that the two pilots can take turns flying it. Bertrand Picard is one of the pilots. He also helped create the project. He says the flight around the world will require that he and the other pilot have a lot of endurance.
It's very exciting for everybody, and we are also in the psychological preparation of the pilot and the team, because technology is okay, but you need to cope now with very long duration flights, single pilot on board for 5 days and five nights, a lot of stress for everybody.
André Borschberg is the other pilot. He helped Mr. Picard create the solar planes. He says that although a computer called an autopilot can fly SI-2, he and Mr. Picard plan to rest or sleep for only 20 minutes at a time. He says the number of times the pilots will be able to rest or sleep every night is difficult to estimate. He says they have trained in a simulator to have 6 to 8 breaks in a 24-hour period. That is about 2 hours of sleep every 24 hours. He says that is not a lot. Bertrand Picard says the goal of the project is to show that renewable energy and clean technologies can be used in other kinds of projects.
If an airplane can fly with no fuel around the world, can you imagine how these technologies could be used everywhere?
SI-2 is to return to Abu Dhabi in July. And that's the VOA Learning English Technology Report. Give us a like on the VOA Learning English Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Learn English. You can also watch videos on the VOA Learning English YouTube channel. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thank you.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. During the 1800s, the federal government forced Native American Indians to live in special areas. These were called reservations. The Indians no longer could move freely over the Great Plains to hunt buffalo. White men were settling there. The situation resulted in violence. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe continue the story of these Western wars.
The government sent soldiers to force the Indians to move to reservations. But the soldiers could not keep them there. Groups of Indians would leave the reservations in the spring. They followed the buffalo across the plains. Some raided the homes of white settlers. They stole horses and cattle. At the end of the summer, the Indians would return to the reservations, and the government would give them food for the winter.
As years passed, fewer Indians left the reservations to live the old life on the plains. It became difficult to find buffalo. The plains were becoming empty. Only a few years before, millions of buffalo lived on the Great Plains. Then railroads were built across the country. White men came to claim the grasslands. They put up fences. Cowboys came up from Texas with huge groups of cattle. They forced the buffalo away or killed them. The Indians tried to prevent this killing. Angry groups of Indians often attacked white buffalo hunters. But the army was too strong. Soldiers killed or captured many Indians. Finally, most Indians gave up the struggle. They surrendered their guns and horses. They went back to the reservations and became farmers.
All this was taking place in what is now the south central part of the United States. Far to the north, another struggle was taking place involving the Great Sioux Indian tribe. The Sioux had signed a treaty with the government in 1868. The treaty gave them a large reservation in what is now Nebraska, South Dakota, and Wyoming. The Black Hills in Dakota were part of the reservation. These hills were important to the Sioux. In their religion, the Black Hills were a holy place. They were the center of their world, where the gods lived. They were the place where Indian fighters went to speak with the Great Spirit.
In 1873, the Black Hills suddenly became important to white men, too. Gold was discovered there. Treaties and religion meant nothing to the white miners who rushed to the Black Hills to search for gold. At first, the Indians killed some of the miners. They chased others away, but more miners came. The Sioux tribe asked the government to enforce the treaty. Tribal leaders asked the government to keep white men away from the reservation. The army sent soldiers to remove the miners. The soldiers ordered the miners to leave, but they made no effort to enforce the order. Again, the Indians protested. This time, the government sent officials to negotiate a new treaty. It asked the Sioux Indians to give up the Black Hills. Some of the Indian leaders refused to negotiate. One who rejected the invitation was Sitting Bull. "I do not want to sell any land to the government," Chief Sitting Bull said. He held a little dust between his fingers. "Not even this much."
This resistance did not stop government efforts to get the Black Hills for the miners. The War Department sent General George Crook to punish the Indians and force them back to their reservation. Crook led a large force into Sioux country. He surprised an Indian village, capturing hundreds of horses. There was another clash a few months later. This time, the result was very different. The Indians gave the army its worst defeat in almost a century.
The battle took place near the Little Bighorn River. General George Custer led 212 soldiers in search of the Indian leader Crazy Horse. As General Custer moved through the river valley, he sent men ahead to explore the area. His men returned with reports that thousands of Indians were waiting to attack. Custer refused to listen. He pushed forward. Soon his forces were surrounded by Indians. In less than an hour, the Indians killed the general and every one of his men. The white soldiers lay dead at Little Bighorn, and Custer's name would go down in history as a symbol of foolish pride in battle. The battle at Little Bighorn was a serious defeat for the United States Army. But the Indians' victory did not last long. Within a year, the army forced most of the Sioux to surrender. It took the Black Hills for the miners. It moved the Indians to a new reservation.
In the next few years, the same thing happened to other Indian tribes throughout the West. Under great pressure from white settlers, the government took land from the Indians and opened it to settlement. The size of Indian reservations was reduced again and again. One by one, the Indian tribes of the West changed. Their fierce fighters became farmers who needed government help. They were weak and broken in spirit. One Indian leader named Black Elk described the situation best. He was a survivor of a battle at a place called Wounded Knee. Many Indian women and children had died there. Years later, Black Elk said, "I did not know then how much was ended. When I look back now from this high hill of my old age, I can still see the dead lying all over the ground, and I can see that something else died there in the bloody mud and was buried. A people's dream died there."
Some Indians turned to religion during this difficult time. An Indian religious leader named Wovoka gained influence. Wovoka declared that the Great Spirit had chosen him to prepare the Indians for a new world. He said the new world would arrive soon, and it would be a wonderful world. There would be no white men, he said, and all dead Indians would come back to life. Wovoka warned that new soil would rise up and cover the world like a flood. He said Indians could escape destruction by dancing a special dance. It was called the Ghost Dance. Wovoka said the Ghost Dance would make Indians powerful. He said it would even protect them from bullets fired by the white men's guns.
Thousands of Indians in the American West listened to Wovoka's message. They believed him, and they began to dance for long hours every day. On the Sioux reservations, all other activities stopped. Children no longer went to school. No one did anything but dance. All this frightened white officials. They tried to arrest some Indian leaders to stop the dancing. The arrests led to fighting, and the fighting led to a final battle in which the army defeated the Indians completely. The Indian wars were over. Wovoka himself told his followers, "Our trails are covered with grass and sand. We cannot find them. Today, I call upon you to travel a new trail. It is the only trail now open. The White Man's Road."
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs are online, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.